Just on housekeeping matters, everyone who's in the class should have now received a list of the study groups, and your name should appear. If your name appears nowhere, then there's a chance you may not exist, in which case it would be very wise to talk to Rossio immediately at the break. The second thing is that at the end, that is at whatever time you finish, somewhere between now and midnight, whenever I have meltdown, you are due to hand in your first mini commentaries. Groups 1 and 4 are submitting their mini commentaries to me. Everyone else is submitting it to Rossio. And we will have two piles up here, and it will be clear where yours belongs. Last bit of housekeeping. Tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock, Christoph Menke is speaking. Christoph, of course, did teach here. Actually, officially, I think I'm his replacement. I am the substitute Menke. And lo and behold, his paper is actually coming out in the graduate faculty journal, so we know what it's about, and it's an attack on Hegel. It's an attack on Hegel for lacking genealogy. So let me begin by saying what I said last time. The spirit of Christianity is a genealogy. It's a genealogy of morals. I have tried to make this kind of obvious. It's a genealogy of Kantian morality. And it's a reading, and I assume every single sentence in Hegel, I just want to be provocative here, is meant to be genealogical. I take it as obvious. Why? Because Hegel says the only thing we philosophers can do is recollect. And if all we can do is recollect, then everything that gets us there must be the path of how we came to be here. Ergo, everything is genealogy in Hegel. I just take that for granted, and I take it for granted, provocatively, that I assume that Nietzsche is a good neo-Hegelian. That said, what I was trying to argue last week is that the presentation was of Judaism as the source, or using the emergence of Judaism and Judaic thought as a way of thinking about the genealogy of Western reason, where the notion of reason was to be thought of in terms of a notion of law. So the question is, how did it come about that we are the sort of folk who take morality to be equivalent to lawfulness, where lawfulness means Kantian universality? I'll be coming, I'll be saying a lot of that comment later this evening. So the thought then, the argument rose up like the flood itself, that this notion of law originally arose as a form of mastering nature, of controlling nature, of taming it. Now, of course, what such a mastery of nature depends upon, so the claim is that our notions of lawfulness is a notion of instrumental reason. And that, unsurprisingly, Hegel is pursuing the critique of instrumental reason, or the critique of law, now read as instrumental reason, that anyway is all over German thought at this time. It's there, of course, in the writings of his friend Herderlin and Schelling, but it's there earlier in Schiller, and it's there in Hamann. It's there all over this period of German thought. Nobody was satisfied with thinking that we could think about everything in accordance with the paradigm of universality and lawfulness. The Newtonian paradigm, after all. And in thinking about that notion, he said it depended on a notion of authority, that law depends on authority. That authority ultimately came down to the notion of an external command. And in order to ground the notion of external command, Hegel suggests you have a double movement. You have to find something beyond the concrete particular, namely the universal, so you control or subsume or have the particular in your grasp by conceptualizing it. Again, this is a trope of German thought, especially Schiller. And Schiller, by the way, I think is, I'll say a bit later, is all over this text. Why people don't say so, I don't know. But his essay, Grace and Dignity, is all over his very Christianity. Now, in order to anchor the distinction between universal and particular, we require, we saw, the distinction between the intelligible and the sensible. So particular is sensible, of course, is life, and the universal is the intelligible, which is going to be law. So we have our fundamental conflict of law versus life. And the idea of law here, when it comes to morality, is then going to be the notion of one ought do certain things. And we ended last time with my suggestion that Jesus came along and wanted to, just this beautiful phrase, to lift nature so that it became holier than the temple. Now, what does he mean by lift nature so that it became holier than the temple? He means nothing more extravagant, I suggested, that if somebody is hungry, you feed them. If they need warmth, you give them a cloak. If they need to be sheltered, you put a roof over their head. That's what it is to make nature holier than the temple. Now, of course, the argument here, and this is the beginning or the beginning of an argument that's going to take me many, many months, and I may never do it, not this year or maybe in my life, Hegel thinks that we can have morality without any ought. That's something about the very notion of ought, as I'll come back to later, but the first person who got this absolutely right was Elizabeth Anscombe, when she said, wherever you hear the word ought, somewhere lurking in there is a God. And the thought is that there's something fishy about the word ought. What can be fishy about the word ought? All morality is ought. You ought to keep your promises. Now, what we need, if I can maybe change it for a moment, is different ears. Because if you can hear that phrase, we ought to keep our promises, and not feel that there's something queer in that, something fishy, then you're not hearing well. Because what are promises? Promises are a binding of yourself to do something. So it looks like what it is for to make a promise is to keep it. That's what it is to make a promise. And if you don't realize that when I promise you I'm going to give a lecture, then, and I don't do it, then either I'm very stupid or mean or I don't know what the word promise means.
Similarly, if I say to Mary, don't kill.
What does the word ought add to don't kill? You ought not to kill. Whenever you hear the word ought, it's the site of anxiety. And the anxiety, of course, is that people are not going to do what is in the very character of the thing, making a promise, fulfilling a need, to do. So that ought is morality under the sign of its failure. Whenever there is the word ought, morality has already disappeared, and it is no longer present. Now, of course, this is why we use the word ought with respect to teenagers. These are the people who don't get it, right? But I think that's partly what it's all about, keeping teenagers in tow. I'm going to come back to that, but I want to have the sense that maybe there's a problem with the word ought. And if there's a problem with the word ought, then maybe since all the moralities, Kantian, utilitarian, even virtue theory says, no, we have principles, all these moralities, think ought's okay. And that makes me think that none of us know what morality is about. That's certainly what Hegel is thinking, that we have not yet what? Not yet heard Jesus. Not yet heard that we don't need that in place of the law we have love thy neighbor. Whatever the hell that means. But that's what Hegel wants to think about, and that's what Hegel wants to beat Kant over the head with in this text. Okay, so I suggested that this would be the replacement of a vertical morality with a horizontal ethics, let's call it. Page 209, Hegel says something typically Hegelian and weird. Since laws are unifications of opposites in a concept, which thus leaves them as opposite, while it exists itself in opposition to reality, it follows that that concept expresses an ought. The hell does that mean? Well, at least I hear it this way. I mean, I don't know, I'm guessing like everyone here. Concepts, he says, these are moral concepts. And he says they are conjunctions, unifications of opposites. So I take it what he means is of something like this. So that the concept would be about breaking promises, don't do it. Of killing your neighbor, don't kill him. Now, so there's two thoughts in a moral thought. And they're opposite thoughts. They're about a state of affairs and its negation. So every deontic principle is saying both P and not P. About killing, don't kill. About breaking promises, don't break, etc. Now, of course, Hegel by the way, thinks that you can't have contradictions in reality. We'll come to that later on, since he's said to believe in contradictions. The only place you can have a contradiction is in proposition land. So the only thing that moral laws could be, since they are themselves unions of contradictions, are concepts. And because they are concepts, they can never enter the world at all. All they can do is regulate it. That is, regulate your actions. Hence, regulation is the notion of their oughtishness. Their oughtishness is their being beyond life. Hence, there is the very notion of ought. Hegel is saying, whenever you hear the word ought, you know morality has gone vertical. It's shot up into the world of concepts and propositions and left the world of life. Now, the problem then arises with what authority are these propositional states, these laws, sustained? How do we sustain the authority of laws? And Hegel says there are three paradigmatic ways in which the authority of laws is kept in place. First, divine fiat. You obey the law because God says so. Now, I don't know what kind of answer that is, but it's simply whatever the answer is that made people quake when Moses, got the laws and said, here they are. God said, don't do it. So God says is the first answer. The second answer is a desublimation of that. It is that the king or the state says, don't do it. Now that's a little better, because at least states, as we know, have a monopoly on legitimate coercion. And if you don't do it, you're going to get punished. So that's a kind of authority. And finally, the third kind of authority, and the most seductive version of it, these forms of authority, right, Hegel calls positivity in this text. Positivity is, as we'll see, his word certainly for reification, but as we'll see, it's also his word for heteronomy. I'll come to that in one moment. So he's something about the state in God, gives law what? What? I mean, as any kid knows, right? When someone says you mustn't do it, and then someone tells you, you ask why, and they say, because God says so. And you say, right, and exactly, he's going to do what to me? And then they say, you're going to go to hell. And then you say, I'm doing it. I mean, you have to believe in a lot of absurd machinery, which, of course, a lot of people do. But you need a lot of absurd machinery to think of authority as coming from God. So what I want to say is the notion of God is what? Is a mystification of authority. That in fact, that God is a placeholder for the problem of authority. That people posited gods because they didn't know with what authority laws or principles were to have, and they were trying to give them some oomph. God is just a big oomph. Just an attempt. But above all, I believe, I really think that's the power of God. God's a question mark for our anxieties about authority. That is, God's the riddle of authority. And whenever, and therefore we make God more and more problematic, mystical, all that, in order to deflect this problem of authority, which in one other version is the source of meaning. So it's a big problem. The state, well, that has its pragmatic features, but then that makes the authority seem, until we discover something like democracy, at least, seem fairly arbitrary. And at this point, Hegel is not thinking about democracy, but roughly any other version of the state, so he's thinking of an arbitrary notion of the law. And hence the third version becomes very exciting to him, and it is the most seductive. And it is that something is obligatory because it is universal. That is, it is universalizable, or has the form of lawfulness in Kant's sense, so that it comes from reason itself. So lawfulness turns out to be something about reason. All right, let me talk about that for a bit. We've really got to get clear about that, because it's going to run through the whole semester. For Kant, begins the groundwork of the metaphysics of morals with the only unconditionally good thing is a good will. And then what makes a good will good is not what it wills, since what it wills is particular, and Kant assumes any willing can have any kind of content. It is rather, if it can't be particular, it can't be about content. It must be particular. If it's particular, it's empirical and contingent. So the goodness of the will cannot be in what it wills, because that's always going to be empirical and contingent. It's always going to be tied to this time, this place. Nothing about that is going to give us a notion of authority, and therefore of rationality. So therefore, it is not what is willed, but how it is willed, where the notion of how, since it cannot refer to content, must refer to form. So the very nature of seeking out this structure leads us right away to the problem of form in opposition to content. That is, already in thinking about it, we're going to generate our universal particular distinction. And the form, according to Kant, is of course that of universalizability. So Kant's thesis, as briefly said as possible, is that a maximum of action? Okay, what's a maximum of action? So, I'm thinking about doing something, and Kant says we do things for reasons. We have general intentions. And when we're trying to think about or deliberate about what to do, we want to think about the particular act at least as having a mini empirical form. So you come to my house, and I'm going to give you a cup of tea. I'm going to give you a cup of tea because my maximum action is when guests come, I offer hospitality. That's all. I mean, nothing grand. That's the maximum under which the giving tea occurs, right? That's the general description. So those, I think, are what Kant means by maxims. They're what he calls subjective principles of action. Maxims are subjective principles of action. And Kant says that to check, what I want to check is whether my maxim of action is universalizable, by which he means, is it a maxim which everyone else could, not would, but could act on? So, could everyone act on the principle when guests arrive, caritas paribus, be hospitable? I imagine a world in which that happens, and I think, oh, that would be a nice world, in fact. Right, no problem there, right? Imagine that. So the principle, well, the first principle of the moral law is act only on that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. Act only on that maxim in which you could at the same time will that it should become a universal law. Now, what Kant suggests here, to make the stakes here, why is this going to be authoritative? What does this have to do with reason? He explains. I think I want to make this absolutely crystal. Otherwise, it's going to be a mess. Universalizability suggests what's called a testing procedure. So I take a maxim. Let's take the most simple, famous example. I will break promises when convenient. That's my maxim of action. So whenever it's in my interest to break a promise, I will break my promise. And of course, that's a very rational thing to do at one level, right? Because if it's convenient, it's because I can get my own way. So when it's convenient for me to deceive you, break a promise, jolly good. Now, the testing procedure has two steps. And I'll be clear about the two steps. The first step is this. Imagine a world in which everyone broke promises as convenient. And we think about, in thinking about such a world, what we have to imagine is what would be the normal or typical empirical consequences of such becoming the law, that is, what everyone does. Well, what would be the consequences? Anyway.
Chaos.
No one would believe anyone's promises, because everyone knows that everyone else breaks their promises when convenient. That's not the problem. That's not Kant's criticism. So there's a second step. And this is why it's a law of reason. If I will to break promises when convenient, then I can only do so by assuming that the institution of promising remains. So in order to will, in order to act on the idea of breaking promises as convenient, I must both will that I will break promises when convenient, and simultaneously will that everyone will keep their promises. And that's a straightforward contradiction. That's a straightforward contradiction, and that's what makes it wrong. It breaks the simplest law of reason, namely, let there be no contradictions. So Kant is using this, and this is why it's very powerful. There's nothing magical here. Kant has found a way of revealing through this procedure of universalizability that roughly all, and there's two forms of testing, contradiction in conception, the one that promises, contradiction in willing. I won't go through all the Kantian literature here, but what he's discovered is most of the things that we're tempted to do that are wrong turn out to be literally contradictory in this way. Now, why contradictory? Well, two thoughts here. First of all, what's the magical moral power here? Well, it's not so magical. What Kant discovered is that when, for example, I will to break promises as convenient, I am free riding. I am a parasite. That is, I am living off of everyone else's goodwill, or what is the same thing as the opposite universality? I'm making an exception in my own case. I am making an exception in my own case. I'm setting myself apart. So sheer logic, sheer reason reveals that what is immoral is egoism or self-interestedness or making myself different from everyone else. That was Kant's discovery. Reason all by itself, unaided, reveals we are bound to one another logically. Logically. Now, the reason why that's the case, and here's the second thing I need to remind you of, and we'll come back in a moment. Hegel agrees with Kant that every act we do, every single action we do, is legislative. Every one of us, in every action we perform, legislates. By which I mean, to do an action is a fortiori to claim this action is the right and proper thing to do. That's what it is to do it. That you can never do an action and unless there's weakness of the will, and that's why weakness of the will exists as a problem, but apart from weakness of the will and such murky things, to do an action just is to say, this is the right thing for me to do, which means it's the right thing for everyone to do. It's just the right thing, because there can't be, this is the right thing for me, but for no one else. Right? There's just no way of logically doing that, except again, when you're concerned with mere contingencies, right? Non-actions which don't have that character. So that each of us is, and this is why Kant's theory is a theory about legislation, we're always legislating in a kingdom of ends. All the time. Everything we do is an act of legislation. Which is why when we do bad things, people take offense. Their offense is you're saying that's the right thing to do. You say, no, 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 I'm just saying it's right for me. You can't say that. You are committed by doing it to claiming it's the right thing. Merely logically. Just a matter of grammar. Just grammar. So Kant is very powerful. Out of reason itself, not anything mysterious here. Of course, there's going to be a bit of mystery coming in a moment. But underneath it, and Hegel agrees with this, Hegel concedes. Hegel says that universality does overcome abstract positivity of civil law and divine fiat. And it does so because, I'm quoting from page 210 to 11, because command here is something subjective. And as subjective, as a product of human power, that is, of reason as the capacity for universality, it loses objectivity, its positivity, its heteronomy. And the thing commanded is revealed as grounded in an autonomy of the human will. So when I obey the moral law, I'm not obeying God or some feudal king. In some way, I'm obeying myself. This is reason as self-determination, right? This is Kant's very claim. And hence, here he just equates positivity and heteronomy. He just says it. So now we know what the word positivity means. It always means heteronomy. Now we can get started. So now comes the problem. And the problem is this. Hegel nonetheless wants to say, and that's what all this stuff about Judaism was working up to, that nonetheless, the Kantian theory contains an intrinsic moment of heteronomy, of being ruled by the outside, of something coercing you in itself. Now, this is going to be complicated, and the reason it's going to be complicated is because the very thing that Kant thought was his own great achievement in the idea of the moral law, namely the way in which the moral law, and now you can see why we have the whole thing on Judaism, what Kant loved about the moral law is it gave us wholesale independence from nature, where nature, of course, is Newton's nature, and therefore from the law of cause and effect. So, if we were governed by our sensibility, for Kant, we were simply governed by drives, by, you know, whatever causal things were happening to us. And therefore, Kant thought we needed to lift ourselves above nature. And that's what just reason in its logical form allowed. Right? Just reason in its logical form. So, that very thing that Kant thought was his achievement, Hegel wants to say, is nonetheless positivity, and therefore nonetheless heteronomy. And part of this, of course, is to see this, part of the story has to be seeing this in its genealogical setting. That is, we comprehend the meaning of the moral law as part of a process of de-sublimation. That is, a process of immanentizing. That is, again, we see the moral law as going from God to the feudal monarch to reason. That is, we have to see it in that chain, is the first thing that Hegel wants to say. But in saying that, in hearing that, he will go on to say, again right here on page 211, and this is what we have to make sense of. The difference between the European prelate who rules church and the man who listens to the command of duty is not that the former make themselves slaves. Right? It just takes it that anyone who listens to a priest or a pope, I mean, this is just good Lutheran stuff, right? That's just slavery, making yourself slave. Why would you be so crazy? But no, the difference is not the former make themselves slaves while the latter is free. That's what Kant thought. But the former have their lord outside themselves while the latter carries his lord in himself, yet at the same time is his own slave. So the thought here is that I have got something in me that I let rule over me. So the thought would be something like, and I take it this is Hegel's thought, Hegel can see nothing in Kantian universality other than a punishing superego. And of course, the point of the moral law, for Kant, is it's meant to punish. And it's meant to punish or humiliate our self-interest. Kant thought that we had this drive, this natural drive, for self-preservation. And the natural expression of the natural drive for self-preservation was to put my interest above the interests of everyone, so that we are, if you wish, hardwired for Kant to be self-interested. And therefore, what we have to do is overcome our hardwiring by something that can humble it, humiliate it, stun it. That's the job of the moral law, which is why Kant uses the loaded language. We are, remember I just talked about mere logic. But Kant says we have to have reverence for the moral law. What? Reverence for the law of non-contradiction? I mean, I appreciate it. I even kind of, yeah, I think it's right, you know. Reverence? So he can only get the moral law to do the kind of work he wants it to do by, in fact, asking it to do two jobs simultaneously. It has to both be a punishing superego, slapping us down, and an ego ideal, something we desire after. And it has to do play both roles. And of course, part of the problem with Kant, this is Dieter Henrich's writings on this are superb, is that it can't do both at the same time. It doesn't know how to. Nothing could do that role, probably. Now, what's this thought of making someone a slave of themselves? And it's this. The condition for this slavery is making something in you absolutely outside you. That's what the moral law is. It's a bit of subjectivity, my very reason, but my very reason is to explode outside me and lift me into a domain of universality outside time and outside nature. Right? So that I have something in me, and then I, because it's me, it's my reasoning, Right? So I enslave myself to the principle in me that itself is an externality. Hence the moral law is a something alien within me. Alien character is what's going on in the fact of reason, right? It's the rebarbative moment in me. Well, what's its alien and objective character? How do we feel that? Same page now. For the particular. Alien with respect to what may be the right question here. Alien with respect to what? Well, Hegel says, for the particular, impulses, inclinations, pathological love, sensuous experience, or whatever else it is called by Kant, the universal is necessary and always something alien and objective. Now, of course, at one level, again, Kant would say, yeah, you bet. I mean, this is why this is a difficult debate. Kant wants to say, but it needs to be alien and objective because we better humble and humiliate those pathological drives you have because on their own, they are just what? Bits of nature. So now we can see that there's really a problem about bits of nature, roughly us, versus another part of us, which is going to be reason. And Kant wants to have the bit of us that is non-nature, reason, rule, master, regulate, the bit of us that is nature. Well, part of Hegel's objection, the first part of Hegel's objection, I'll get to the second part in a moment, part of Hegel's objection here is just straightforward Nietzschean. It's this. This is a moral law is a slave morality because it poses a product of life. I mean, for Kant, you know, the moral law doesn't come from it. And by reminding us that everything comes from somewhere, that nothing belongs to a Platonic world of universals, right? Hegel is therefore saying, look, whatever the moral law is, it's a product of life, because everything is a product of life, can't be a product of anything else, because there is nothing else, right? So we have his anti-mysticism. But therefore, what the complaint is simply that abstract ideals are in reality products of life, and therefore the opposition between law and life is logically equivalent to reifying a moment of life and calling it not life and then giving it authority as not life. Right? And that is, by the way, the fundamental gesture of what the genealogy of morals is all about. This is why I'm saying the argument is perfectly Nietzschean. That argument just runs through as just unproblematic Nietzschean, which is why for Nietzsche, quite rightly, right, even slave moralities are originally productive. Because all products of life originally are forms of affirmation, and they only become negative. And Hegel is again saying exactly the same thing. He's thinking that, not that Kant said the wrong thing, it's that he stopped too soon. So what Hegel wants to do, and why he wants to do it, we'll make clear, is say, the problem was not that we went from God to king to reason, but that we have to go one step further. We have to continue the process of internalizing these abstract reifications or products of life So we require a further internalization. And of course, the idea of further internalizing, again, is in the culture, right? It's what Protestantism is, further internalizing. You take the priest and you put him inside you, and you become the priest. That was what Luther said. Every man is his own priest. Internalization. So Hegel is working out this Lutheran thought against Kant, who we say now is a bit of a papist and a Jew, is what he's saying about Kant. But he thinks that, and this is the switch now, that the work of a further internalization means we must not see products of life as opposed to life. Therefore, we must drop the logic of universal and particular, and we're going to replace it by what he says is every product of life, every command, he says, is a modification of life. A modification which is exclusive and therefore restricted only if looked at in reference to its object. So the thought here is if the Kantian scheme is about the relationship between law and case, universal and particular, which leaves the particular nonetheless separate, outside, ontologically distinct, the Christian scheme is about the relationship between a virtuous disposition to love thy neighbor and loving thy neighbor. Which is to say, between potentiality and action. So that rather than thinking of occasions as things which get in the way of the universal, the occasions now are opportunities, occasions to express, in this case, your loving disposition. So we begin with a language of modification, or maybe if you're a Spinozist, a logic of modes, right? So love is a modification of life, reconciliation is a modification of love, virtues are collectively modifications of love. So everything is a mode of something else. He's just trying to get this holistic logic of modification, potentiality, and actuality. Now, what is important about this is the command now, love thy neighbor, loses its oughtishness. So the command form, love thy neighbor, is not like you ought to keep your promises, because there is nothing of the self that is to be opposed to it, or to put the same thought this way, for Hegel, there is no, I want to be careful about my words here, there is no intrinsic source of resistance to doing the right thing. It's not that people always do the right thing. There are temptations to do bad things, temptations to be self-interested. But Hegel takes it, and this will be a part of the phenomenology, how he deals with emotions and affects. But let's just put it this way, that for Hegel, opposed to Kant, emotions and affects are culturally, socially saturated. And they aren't intrinsically either self-interested or other-interested. we are born with drives, and they get articulated and expressed in a variety of ways. But there's nothing, the notion of self-interest that drives Kant so crazy is really a part of what? It's part of trying to think about morality in a Newtonian framework, where the drive of self-preservation is introduced as the principle of inertia. This is explicit in Hobbes. In Hobbes, right? Right? Because you desire and desire until death. So the drive of self-preservation is literally the law of motion. And almost everything that goes wrong in Kant, as is often the way in Kant, goes wrong because he inherits and takes over conceptual schemes that are antagonistic to his own thought. Everything that goes wrong in the first critique is because he read Hume too closely. Everything that I think that goes wrong in his moral philosophy is because he read Hobbes too well. Listened too hard to Hobbes's theory of emotions, and therefore took the view, right, that we are intrinsically self-interested characters. As if, I don't even know what it would mean to think in those terms. It is a false naturalization of the structure of human desires and drives. Okay. So, if, and by the way, I mean, this is... next year, I think Professor Critchin will be teaching Levinas again. Levinas is another one who thinks everyone is a teenager, who thinks we all have to do what we ought to do, only what slaps us on the face now is the face of the other. I know Levinas, I just find Levinas comic. I'm sorry. Moral philosophy for teenagers, not grown-ups. But no, I take this to be a real problem, because I take it to be our problem. That is, I'm not sure we know what a moral philosophy for grown-ups is yet. So of course I say that, I meant to say provocatively, and you bit, but now I want to turn back on myself and say, but wait a minute, before you laugh, maybe we better figure out how it is we can be grown-ups. It's just not so easy or clear. And I take it that's Hegel's problem in all of his texts, is what is it to be grown-ups? Or, I take it the same thing, how can we be fully secular human beings? Same thought. Because obviously being a child is believing in authority, believing in a God or a parent. And there simply are none to tell us what to do. Okay, so Hegel wants to generate an imminent ethical view, and in order to do that, he thinks he has to do is show, let's think about it in obvious ways. I've just been arguing, trying to argue, that the notion of self-interest or egoism or any of these phrases is not, as it were, in the structure of the metaphysical structure of the universe. And it is a construction of a particular society, a particular time, a particular place, right? All the things that, for example, Rousseau argued against Hobbes.
Yeah. Can I ask a question? Just yeah. Clarification? I mean, if we are moving beyond Hobbes, Kant, Newton, human nature, drives, impulses, life is but a motion of limbs, this kind of thing, But we still have these particulars that are impulses and inclinations, pathological
bonds,
centers, experience, or whatever else it's called.
Right.
I take it there's a terminological crisis here. If we're not in human nature...
Good. Well, we are in human nature. Well, we're not in conscious
nature.
We're not in conscious
nature. What human nature are we doing?
Right. Yeah, yeah. So we need at least an idea for another notion of human nature. And you're absolutely right. Right, perfect segue. Because what Kant has defined is within these nasty affects, he has to find an affect that is not intrinsically self-regarding. Of course, this turns out not to be so difficult, because we have one affect that is intrinsically other-regarding, love. So, Hegel thinks that we can get a clue, and I love the way Paul Huntley just helped me out here, to get a clue how to think about a different version of human nature, and therefore a different version of society, by using love as a logical clue. Now, of course, maybe love and logic don't belong in the same phrase, but I want them to, because I think what's at stake here is the grammar of love or the logical form of love. So what I want to do now is have desperately, I want to have a cigarette, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the grammar of love. I'm going to stop there.